The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here. And I have to say, we've had a bit of a drought since our last honest discussion about sex at the library. Sex in the library, we talk about all the time, but that's another story. The last event that I can recall that was devoted to the topic of sexuality was an evening with Dr. Ruth about 10 years ago, when we talked about Sex for Dummies, which was one of her new books at the time, The Poetry of Desire, and Kegel Exercises, which I've just learned men can actually do, so I'll practice those later. In short, it's time that we had a discussion. And to lead our discussion this evening, we are joined by Erica Zhang, poet and author of 8 New York Times bestsellers, as well as the officially immortal Fear of Flying. Her latest book, Sugar in My Bowl, Real Women Write About Real Sex, provides our point of departure. Ms. Zhang will be joined on stage by contributors Julie Clam, author of the memoir Please Excuse My Daughter, and most recently You Had Me at Wolf, a collection of hilarious lessons learned from her pets, and Philadelphia native and former Inquirer writer Karen Abbott, whom you know is the author of the bestsellers Sins in the Second City and American Rose, the story of Gypsy Rose Lee. Please welcome Erica Zhang, Julie Clam, and Karen Abbott.
This is Julie, and this is Karen, and I'm incredibly grateful to them for coming with me to do this evening about Sugar in My Bowl. You probably know that Sugar in My Bowl is a blues song made famous by the great Bessie Smith, and it has really raunchy lyrics. I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little hot dog on my roll. I can stand a bit of lovin', oh so bad. I feel so funny. I feel so sad. I would sing it for you, but I can't sing. Nina Simone also recorded it and kind of cleaned it up. So she made it a song about love instead of a song about sex. But I like the Bessie Smith version better. Anyway, I got talked by a publisher into doing an anthology of women writing about sex. And at the beginning, I was incredibly dubious about it. Then, when the pieces began to come in from various wonderful women writers, I was greatly encouraged because they were all so diverse. Julie Clam, for example, wrote, Let's Not Talk About Sex. And Karen Abbott wrote a wonderful piece called Herman and Margot about the topic that is really the most taboo topic about sex, and that is sex between old people. If you ask me, are there any taboos left? Absolutely. We rarely see movies about sex between the elderly, love between the elderly, romance between the elderly, but Karen dared to do it, and her story is based on a true story between two people in a retirement home. And she's going to give us a little taste of it, because this is truly the new taboo subject.
I got into this. I blame all of my taboo subjects on my grandmother, who was 93. And a few years ago, I was watching TV with her, and a Priceline.com commercial came on with William Shatner. You know, he was lamenting his travel woes. And my grandmother suddenly sort of gets very attentive and leans forward and looks at the TV and says, he's still got it. I said, you know, the Shat? Really, Grandma? You know, didn't even bring up the fact that, you know, my grandmother was, you know, 90 at the time, and I guess William Shatner was in his late 70s, so there was a little bit of cougar action going on there. But this story got me thinking about the nature of desire and how that would evolve over time, even decades, and the really very human need to pursue and be pursued, and how that changes or doesn't change. So with that in mind, I contacted Cate House, which was this retirement community in the Bronx, and was lucky enough to hook up with a very interesting couple there. Herman was 92 years old when I met him, and Margo was 87. And Herman had been there for quite some time and was sort of a well-established patriarch of the place. If anybody had a problem, they knew to go right to Herman, and he fixed everything. And he took it upon himself to greet every new resident. So Margo walks in on one summer day, and of course Herman is right there, and she sort of sidles up on her walker. And the first thing she says to him is, "Where do you get an air conditioner in this place?" And he said, "I will order one for you." And that was that. And they were sort of inseparable ever since. So I'm going to just read a brief excerpt of the relationship between Herman and Margo. "In the beginning, they take things slowly, reveling in the irony of teasing time when they have so little left of it. Margo invites him up to her apartment to watch Dancing with the Stars. He's gorgeous, by far the best man she's seen here, clean cut in his polo shirt and black trousers and spotless white sneakers. They revel in their similar virtues. Both are spirited, funny, adventurous, and neither recognizes that they also possess the same faults. She obstinately insists that he is too opinionated. His strong opinion is that she's too obstinate. One day, Herman presents Margo with a bottle of cologne and waits for her reaction. I have to retrain him, she thinks, and decides to tell him the truth. You don't give me cheap cologne, she says. I won't use that junk. He calls her dame and pussycat. Worse, his romantic technique lacks preamble and subtlety. It seems he has 14 hands, clutching her arm and grabbing at her neck, and when he kisses her, his mouth lands heavy on hers, as if it dropped from stories above. She calls him the wolf. Herman won't hear any of it. The thing is, even if he were a young man, he wouldn't marry Margot. He takes her to City Island for dinner, and all she does is complain that they never go anywhere else. During a trip to Las Vegas, he buys her a necklace from a shop at Caesar's Palace. I don't like it, she says, her lips, but God, those lips, sputtering in disgust. If you gave me $100, I wouldn't wear it. She is difficult and contrary. She has her own ideas. She won't listen to him or deviate from her structured but nonsensical path. She's not wife material, but she's the kind of dame he'd have a fling with, that's for sure. And he pays more visits to apartment 12H, he dares himself to go further and further, both old enough to know better and too old to care. So now here's a truth that will always take a lifetime to discover. Your last time is no easier than your first. Margot is yielding to him, casting off her blazer, stepping out of her slacks, kicking her orthopedic stilettos across the floor. He does what she likes best and caresses her arm gently with studied focus. His dentures graze her neck. He finds her lips, whisks his tongue inside her mouth. They tousle in slow motion. Her artfully arranged hair doesn't move. His hands know well what they're doing, touching her breast, touching her behind, maybe even going a little further than that, he says. His fingers move with experience now, with precision, and he feels that she's enjoying it very much, a passionate girl, his Margot, in all senses of the word, for better or for worse. It is hard to get hard now. There's no other way to say it. But his body knows the stakes and anticipates the reward. A few minutes, maybe, and the pale but prideful hope that he will earn his place in her memories. Something melancholy in the capture, at once a brilliant awakening and irrevocable loss. She lets him find her, and there's nothing between them now. Not the slim, uncertain wedge of their futures, nor the long, tangled sprawl of their past. So that was Herman and Margot. Thanks. Thank you.
It's really beautiful. I hope someone will dare to write a novel about love and sex between 80-year-olds. It probably would reach a huge audience. You know, the baby boom generation is aging. Julie Klam wrote a piece called Let's Not Talk About Sex, and it turned out that her piece was in some ways a bookend to my daughter Molly's. My daughter Molly's piece was a piece called They Had Sex So I Don't Have To. And, you know, like all daughters, she takes me as her satirical material in a similar way to the way Julie Klam takes her mother as satirical material
yeah.
in Please Excuse My Daughter. But Molly and Julie both had the same problem, which is nudist parents. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
I grew up, my parents were just naked too much and too long. And they still are. I mean, my mom and dad are in their 70s, and my husband actually said that he's seen my mother naked more times than he's seen me naked. They're just not aware of the clothing issue. And it turned me into like a Victorian, it's not a prude, but I very embarrassed about talking about, sex. And it, when Erica, asked me if I would write a piece, I think I turned like as red as this tablecloth, and she wanted, it was at the time the book was called The Best Sex I Ever Had, and I was like, oh my God, to even think about it, let alone write about it. And I said, I can write about not writing about sex. And she said, okay. And I was, at the time, my daughter was about, just about to turn six, and I realized that she still referred to her vagina as the front, because I did, and it started to get very confusing, because then she thought she had two tushies, and there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of issues with that, and I was like, really had to steel myself to get it. I mean, I just blurted that word out here, but it took a very long time for me to say it to my daughter and explain that that was the name for it. And it's my parents' lack of shame turned me into like the most embarrassed person on the planet. But Erica's daughter, Molly, and I are good friends, and we frequently try to one-up each other on the most embarrassing thing that happened. Recently, I was at my parents' house with my daughter, who's now 7 and a half, and she came downstairs, and my mom came running down, and it was like about 7:30 in the morning, and said, oh my God, Violet just walked in on us having sex, her and my dad. And my parents don't have a door on their bedroom, and I said, why were you having sex at 7:30 in the morning when your little granddaughter is here? And she said, well, their other granddaughters were there for 2 weeks. She said, we hadn't had sex for 2 weeks. And, my aunt said, what do they need to have sex for? They want to have more children? So it's sort of like now she's doing, my kid was like, whatever. My mother said that my father, she said, Papa had a bad dream and she was comforting him. So we're sort of going with that.
Is it a primal scene if it's your grandparents? I wonder, you know, I wonder about that. Well, where do you think sex is now? I mean, is sex in a different place than it was when the baby boomers were in their prime? What do you think about it? It's very hard to generalize about cultural trends. And I've been taking a lot of flack for the article I wrote in the New York Times last week, which is about, is sex passé? I don't really believe that sex is passé, but I believe that being public about it, perhaps, for my daughter's generation, Julie's generation.
Yeah. Everybody but Anthony Weiner.
Yeah. There are different attitudes. People feel that sex has been overexposed. Certainly it's been overexposed on the internet. There's no doubt about that. But do you feel there's a difference in the way people talk about it, feel about it today?
I mean, I think that it's gotten to the point where everything's been said, everything's been shown, and everything's been done that, you know, in order to sort of bring something new to it, you need to sort of pull back. And I mean, I think, you know, most people agree that it was a much sexier movie to watch Cary Grant fully clothed than, you know, the things that they're doing today. And I kind of think that there is a boomerang happening. I think, you know, we have talked about that, you know, things changed after, I mean, there was birth control, but then there was AIDS. So there have been different points in history where sexuality was different. And I think now it's finding, I mean, I hope it's not, with all of these, recent scandals, that's what it's turning into. But I think it has to find a new place.
What do you think, Karen?
Well, I think we were talking about this a little bit last night. It's sort of a main component of sexiness is something has to be hidden, and nothing is hidden anymore. And so there's just that sort of erosion of true sexiness. I'm personally, and I write about this in history, just endlessly fascinated with the contradictory attitude towards sex. Sex is everywhere. It's inescapable. And yet we're so incredibly punishing to anyone who displays any sexuality. The case in point of Anthony Weiner most recently. And it's sort of more frightening to me. It's not frightening to me that Anthony Weiner had these urges and granted he did not maybe handle them in the most appropriate or mature way, to say the least. I'm more frightened of the fact that, you know, I went to 16 years of Catholic school, so I'll probably get stricken down for saying this, that the Catholic Church can sort of hide pedophiles for decades and get away with doing that. That's a scarier aspect of sexuality to me than anything Anthony Weiner's done. Mm. So.
Well, you know, my generation grew up with locked book rooms in libraries. You couldn't get a copy of Lady Chatterley's Lover. Ulysses had already been liberated, but in my growing as a writer, I read Portnoy's Complaint and Couples by John Updike and thought, where is the woman who writes about that? And that was part of my motivation in writing Fear of Flying. My daughter's generation, on the contrary, felt that sex was everywhere and that there was too much of it, and she never encountered a locked book room. Everything was available for her to read. Perhaps there was a muchness of it that she felt was unsexy. So it was a very, very different experience between her generation and mine. Also, she was the generation that heard about Allie Gertz getting AIDS, and she realized that girls could get AIDS from a one-night stand. And they were all very nervous about it. So there definitely is a generational difference in the ideas about sexuality. And I begin to think that there is something really amazing about fantasy, sexual fantasy, and unconsummated desire. In fact, it's easier in some way to write about unconsummated desire than consummated desire. And my story in this book is called The Kiss, and it's a short, short story about an unconsummated passion. And I was intrigued when writing it because I thought, here's the secret. They both go away with their fantasies untouched, and they can keep their fantasies rather than the reality, which might be disappointing. So I really am interested in the whole idea of secrecy, privacy, and the sexuality of secrecy. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Julie?
I think it's sort of what I was saying before is that there are no secrets. There's social networking of everything. Everything is said and everything is out there. And it's certainly more desirable to, when you tell somebody something, it's out there. When you have it, you know, in your mind, it's your own, and it's, you know, infinitely more exciting.
How could you have Romeo and Juliet on a social network? The climactic scene in Romeo and Juliet takes place when they miss each other. She comes and thinks he's dead. He's not dead. She takes poison and dies. He awakens. How would you translate that?
Well, they would have texted each other so they would yeah. know that they were okay yeah. now.
And the tragedy really is the lack of communication.
Yeah.
And that they cannot inform each other of everything. And many of the greatest love stories are about that. Mm-hmm. Dante Alighieri never talks to Beatrice. Beatrice never talks to him. So yeah. a lot of love is secrecy, don't you think? A lot of the
yeah.
piquancy of it.
It's interesting when you in contrast to communicating today, you know, I'm researching the Civil War right now and just, you know, the entire courtship, there's no touching, you know, there's no kissing. You did not kiss until you got married. And, you know, obviously back in the Victorian era. And so the entire relationship is built on unconsummated desire, and sort of a prolonged unconsummated desire. And, just sort of, I guess the satisfaction and just inherent in that, just knowing that there is desire and that it's going to be fulfilled, but yet, the waiting for it is the pleasure. And that's entirely lost now. And of course, just the art of communication is entirely lost too. If you go back and reread the way people used to write in the Victorian era, it's a little bit more, florid and I guess satisfying than the text messages, that even Romeo and Juliet would send, I think. So.
That's true. Also, in my piece for this book, I talk a little bit about the beauty of kissing and not having sex. I'm going to read you a little bit of that. He greeted me with vintage champagne and fresh chocolate-covered cherries. We ate and drank and spoke haltingly. Then we retreated to the couch, wrapped our arms around each other, and began to kiss. It was a kiss that went back to the birth of the universe, the making of stars, the sculpting of humans out of clay. It was a mitochondrial kiss in which generations were born, died, and were buried, in which trees leaped out, bloomed, fell, and rotted, and gave birth to new forests. It was a kiss that moistened oceans, grew the universe, swirled through the cosmos. His tongue, my lips, my tongue, his lips, everything merged in the waters of the womb of his mother, the penis of his father, the souls of his grandparents. A kiss can be an IOU or the end of a love affair. A kiss can last for eons. A kiss can be longer and stronger than a fuck. A kiss has a history and a future. But what was its future? In the first ending, we go to bed, are deeply disappointed, and never see each other again. In the second ending, we go to bed, discover lifelong passion, and turn our lives upside down, saddening spouses, children, parents. But I have chosen an alternate ending. I get up from the couch, run to one of the many glamorous marble bathrooms to pee, dress quickly, then I sneak out the front door of the suite. Now I can keep his kiss for the rest of my life. I've become intrigued with the unconsummated, maybe because we see so much consummation around us, and also because I got so sick of being the literary happy hooker. So I've been exploring these alternate ways of making love. And this book is very interesting because in it, you have love between children, love between old people, fear of love, unconsummated love. I can't imagine a book written by men that would have so many aspects of desire and so many occasions in which desire is not consummated, and yet there's a strong feeling of eroticism and sex. And I do think, Karen, in you researching this, the Civil War, you're discovering these prolonged courtships,
yeah.
which are really fascinating to me. Imagine, I mean, we have something like that in Liaison Dangereuse with the letters that are exchanged. But when you research earlier periods in Love and Desire, you see this brinkmanship. And it's truly fascinating to me.
Yeah. And just sort of the art, there was an art to it that is completely lacking today or just dead. The walk of shame. You know, there's no art in sort of a text and a one-night stand and walk of shame. It's sort of a lamenting that, too.
And often the ubiquitous hookup is not satisfying for either party. You know, it may be satisfying perhaps for the man, but there is no real intimacy. And for women, hookups are frequently unsatisfying. So you can have it, but what do you lose by having it?
Well, I think it's also we've talked about men and women's views of sex and that, what is foreplay to a woman could be a conversation and an entirely different thing. And I think what leads up to it, there's a lot more mental parts for women.
Also for men. Men can be incredibly romantic and can imagine a whole interaction before it occurs.
Right.
And in fact, you know, the French have this phrase, la carotte est cuite, the carrot is cooked. And supposedly when the carrot is cooked, men lose interest. Certainly that could be Dominique Strauss-Kahn, you know, who must have sex with anybody who's near.
Yeah.
Chambermaid.
That carrot is rotten.
The carrot is rotten. But it is novelty that he seeks. I don't think that women seek novelty as much. Some do.
Yeah.
Some do.
It's an interesting, on the flip side of romance, there was a really interesting article in New York Magazine recently about the proliferation of porn and the expectations that puts on women. And men are not interested in their girlfriends anymore or attracted to their girlfriends anymore and instead make sort of date nights with their favorite YouTube porn videos, which was really disturbing and sort of very uniquely, to this very specific generation. And I thought, something that I'm so grateful I don't have a teenage daughter. Something that, these girls are going to be grappling with in a way that I can't even imagine.
How can you measure up to the woman on the screen? How can you measure up to her great perfection? She has no moles, no scars.
No inhibitions.
So sex is a very psychological phenomenon, and you will see the whole range of it in this book from a woman's point of view. The thing that disappointed me is I never got a hot lesbian contribution. many women wrote to me and said, Erica Jong, you're too heterosexual. You don't understand woman-on-woman sex. And yet, There are avowed lesbians in this book who chose to write about heterosexual experiences, and that disappointed me. I would have liked to have woman on woman sex.
Did they give? I'm curious. Did they give a reason? Where was the line drawn for many of the people writing?
I don't really know.
Yeah.
I have great respect for writers, and I would never force a writer to write about something she didn't want to write about.
Of course.
But I thought that when I chose these writers who I knew were lesbians, that they would write about lesbian sex, and they didn't.
They duped you.
Both of them wrote about the first sexual experience with a man. Fascinating. Maybe it's too scary to write about the forbidden subject of lesbian sex, but I hope we will find, that experience. I don't think that Gertrude Stein ever wrote about hot lesbian sex, nor did Alice B. Toklas. And even the famous lesbian writers of the 20s are not very explicit. So that's something missing in this book, and I hope if there's another edition, I'll be able to fulfill that lack. But we have practically everything else. And we have a lot of younger writers who have not appeared anywhere else before, and a lot of older writers like Faye Weldon and Liz Smith writing about their own experiences. So that was fascinating to me. Where do you suppose sex is going in our culture? Will there be sex in 100 years?
What did Molly say last night? No, there will be no sex. There will just be sort of robots floating and vaguely touching each other. I would hope that that an element of the hidden returns. You know, I always think that this sort of pendulum will swing back. And I can only hope for that as someone who, you know, prefers to keep lots of things hidden. I really admire the women who shared personal experiences. Like I said, I only like to write about sex involving very old people or very dead people. So my hat's off to people who actually talk about the living experience of that.
Even in your book about Gypsy Rose Lee, we didn't get any explicit sex.
Well, she was a very private person. Here's somebody who was the queen of keeping things hidden. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I admired her for that. And I think, you know, there are reasons that people are always drawn to women like her and why she is such an icon. I think that's a very significant part of her appeal.
She was amazing.
Yeah.
Actually. And her appeal was hiddenness also. You know, what she didn't take off was the crux of the matter. She was very, there was a lot hidden, even in her striptease routine.
Yeah, that was the
whole. And that was the secret of it. So I think it's very interesting, and maybe we'll reclaim it. I would like to see people go back to writing love letters and not by email. I think that computers have taken away an element of mystery in our lives. I would like to see people pinning love letters on trees as they do in As You Like It. But I'm very romantic. I like that sort of thing. And I hope we will eventually come back to it. One of the most astonishing pieces in this book is by Linda Gray Sexton, the daughter of Anne Sexton, who is a wonderful novelist and memoirist. And she writes a piece about the sexuality of asphyxiation. And it is astounding. It is really an astounding piece. And perhaps because it's so dangerous, people are drawn to it. People have died doing asphyxiation to heighten their sexual feelings. And Linda has dared to write about this. And her piece is very interesting because at the end of it, the person with whom she shared this astounding experience actually has a sex change operation and becomes a woman. So in a way, her...
So be careful if you do that.
Don't try that at home. Yeah.
Yeah, don't try that at home. Right? So it's very interesting how much that was a piece that really surprised me tremendously. Eve Ensler, who wrote the Vagina Monologues, did a monologue of three women, or a trialogue of three women talking about their sexual experiences. So she wrote in the form of a dramatic piece, and that was very interesting. Eve is really a hippie of the 60s. She believes if we're open about sex, we'll be open about everything. She believes that the deficit will not destroy our country if we all go out and have sex. She's very funny on this particular issue. She really believes in free sex. I don't know if I completely agree with her anymore, because I've seen where that's taken our society. And pornography on the internet has gone relentlessly, relentlessly down market. And one tends to forget that sexuality, we started out wanting to be able to read Ulysses, and we wound up with Debbie Does Dallas. And it seems somewhat sad in a way.
Yeah.
Do you have any other points you want to make, Julie?
No, I was just thinking, I never saw Debbie Does Dallas.
Yeah.
Did somebody say don't?
It was not that good, right?
No, I think I saw the documentary, though, on Debbie Does Dallas.
Or on Deep Throat.
Yeah, that was it.
I was in the Deep Throat documentary about Deep Throat. Deep Throat was a very sad movie, I think. We'd love to take some questions from the audience. Yes.
I'm just curious, when you said your greatest disappointment about this book was that the two lesbians didn't talk about their women and women sex. And I understand the fact that you would never ask a writer to write something that they didn't want to write. But if this was such a deep disappointment, couldn't you have suggested it? I mean, writers communicate. I can't, you know, between contemporary women, that you couldn't have had this. You certainly had a conversation about the book, so you couldn't have this conversation and ask.
No, I'm very gentle with writers. I don't tell them what to write. I mean, I think that one of the reasons this is a good book is because every writer sort of picked her own subject. I mean, they did discuss with me what they were going to write about, and I wanted a great range of things. So I pushed them. I also edited their individual pieces and pushed them very hard to write better and more frankly. But I wasn't going to tell them what to write about. I don't believe in that. Any other? Yes.
I have to disagree with you a little. I was on when I was younger raised, you know, exposed to libraries where all the sex books were in drawers. We've come to another level. Last year here, I was asked to read at the Banned Books Week. I'm a clinical sexologist and I run the Erotic Literary Salon, so it made sense. The ACLU asked me to come here, and the library. And I came here with flyers for my Sensexual Salon, and I was not allowed to put them out.
You were?
I was not allowed to put them out. It had the word sex in it.
Yeah, this happens still. I mean, you may know that when you have a subject line in an email that has sex in it, you have to write S-X, otherwise it goes into the spaminator.
Yeah. The internet is definitely censoring. I mean,
yeah, it definitely is.
I had to change the Erotic Literary Salon to read the Philadelphia Cultural Salons when I'm sending things in the emails, because there's censorship. So even though we say we're free and we have all this freedom to do things, we don't.
That's
there is censorship
true.
Also of fantasies.
That's true. I mean, I remember many years ago we couldn't take television ads for fear of flying. And I think if any publisher would pay for them today, it would still be hard. Yes.
I'd like to take issue a little bit, too. I just finished 21 years of campus ministry at the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And I'm well acquainted with the objectification and the hookup culture.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening here is that we're confusing quantity of sex and the objectification that happens with the real issue, which is nobody's teaching quality sex. Nobody's mm-hmm. talking about what the marks of an intimate, a healthy relationship are. And nobody is giving this generation the language to talk about relationship development. So I don't think we have to go to just keeping it fantasies or keeping it private and secret. I think we can live it, but there's no place in the culture that's really helping people get to that point of understanding that the mind is the most powerful sex organ that there is.
Absolutely,
which you're articulating
right.
Very well.
And people are very much afraid of intimacy. There's no doubt about it. And we have a narcissistic culture in which intimacy is hard, and people don't know how to be intimate, whether in sex or not in sex.
Yeah.
I think you have some ideas about that.
Oh, I would agree with that. You know, it's not something that... It's also, how do you teach that? It's sort of, you know, how do you teach that, you know, how many parents really sit their children down and say, this is what a good relationship is. And you either have that example because your parents have a good one, or you don't have that example. And it's not something you discuss with your peers. You discuss with how hot somebody looks, you know, in their jeans. So it's sort of, it's a good point. There's just no way to sort of, to develop an understanding of that.
It's really imitative. If you grow up among people who are capable of intimacy, that is modeled for you. So you imbibe it through watching people being intimate. But sex without intimacy is of no interest to me. And there's an awful lot of it out there. There's no doubt about that. You're absolutely right. There's a question back there.
Could it be we're on is it possible that we're on a new frontier of romance and sex, in that is it possible that we underestimate this generation of critical thinkers, in that the previous generation has not really well taught intimacy or romance? The thing that I remember most is being raised by grandparents, and their intimate moments, as far as I was concerned, or as far as I was led to believe, would be a kiss on the cheek. For them, that was very romantic in their generation, and that was serious business. And in that generation, they picked our friends. So I couldn't know a female that my grandparents had not had dinner with their grandparents, that kind of thing. So it's a different generation. When I was an adult, I had to learn some of the things, I guess, that kids learn as juveniles today. But I would suggest that we're touching on romance, and I don't know whether it's... I feel I'm a romantic, and I look at Henry Miller, and I look at Hemingway and different people, and I find romance in their writing. I don't suggest that there's a difference between a male romantic and a female romantic. I think it can be generic, but...
Henry Miller was a very romantic writer.
Right.
And very courtly, but he was branded a pornographer by people who didn't understand.
No, I'm saying as someone who read Henry Miller and did not find it pornographic, who found it enlightening, I think...
Absolutely
right.
When
we came along, I think Walter Benton was a very romantic poet writer. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about being on a new frontier instead of just writing off this generation as not knowing what they're doing?
I am not writing off this generation at all. I think they grew up with different, problems than ours. I'm not writing them off at all.
Can I suggest...
Yeah. I don't know what a new frontier is, aside from Kennedy.
In another generation, we thought that, okay, in the 60s, certain people had abortions and other people had female procedures. Now, then abortion became okay. You understand? But it was still abortion from each generation. So what I'm suggesting is, are we dealing with a substance of terms, or in reality, are there still romantic people out there?
I'm sure there are romantic people. Yes. Yes.
I just had one question also following up on the others about hidden and not hidden. I think we talk about sex but not sexuality. And even couples of any age, 20s to 40s, still have trouble talking to their partner about pleasure. Mm-hmm. And so I think despite being good at talking about objectified sex, even if we're talking about deep relationships, kind of pleasure is not there. And the most liberated women still can't talk to their daughters about exploring their own bodies and claiming their own sexuality. So it's a very weird contradiction.
You're not talking about me, are you?
No. No. But you know what I mean? I said there's sex, but there's not sexuality. There's not pleasure. I don't think we're still very good at talking about that, and I don't think it's talked about.
I don't think that's true. There's a piece in this book about a little girl who's masturbating and her mother's response and her mother's attempt to tell her that it's okay, but don't do it at school, and that eternal, you know, that eternal... I don't want to make my kid feel bad, but at the same time, I don't want her doing it in public. It's a lovely and funny piece about that whole issue. We're not good at communicating about sexuality, about intimacy, maybe because we ourselves have inhibitions. I'm not quite sure what it's about. But we should be better at communicating, and we should be better at intimacy. There's no doubt about that. Yes, there's a question over there.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment. There's a wonderful Spanish film about an elderly couple, and it's called Sylvia and Fred. And they are making films about older people having sex.
Not many, but they are. Yeah,
yeah, I was going to say.
Right. It's
there
true.
Should be more.
Yeah. There should be. There are people in the back who are not. Aha.
Hello. So I think that those of us who are frustrated about where we are culturally or confused about where we are, I'm 33, I'm a single professional woman, and I find myself frustrated and confused about where we are culturally. And it's not just with respect to sex. It's with respect to everything. It's with respect to social justice. It's with respect to the role of women. I mean, it cuts everywhere. And a lot of the conversation that I hear about it is wishing that we could go back to mm-hmm. a place when it was better. Because we've gone so far in the wrong direction that if we don't go back... We're nowhere, right? We self-destruct. And I'm not suggesting that's what you're saying, but I don't think we've ever seen that throughout the course of human history. Like we've evolved, right? We've adapted and we've moved forward. And so jumping off your conversations about posting the notes on the trees and things like that and the love letters, I mean, that sounds amazing to me, and I try to incorporate things like that in my own life. But I'm not sure that we're ever going to go back to a place where the world works like that. And so I wonder if any of you have ideas or you've seen any places where technology has actually fostered romance and intimacy, and what are the positives that it can bring? Because I think that's where we are. Like, I don't think we can go back. It's inevitable, and we have to figure out a way to use it the way that it is. So I wonder if you have any ideas or you've seen anything that's worked or is working.
Oh, well, I think that, you know, absolutely that there are positives in that, you know, you can discover somebody that you haven't talked to since high school and, you know, find out that somebody that you had a crush on and didn't come out looking so good in the end, and that's always helpful. I think a lot of the connecting is that there's a lot of positive connecting, and I think the fact that we can be in touch with people you know, it's definitely we're saturated, and you know, we are. I think we all lament the fact that we're totally reachable at every second, and you could also be seen at every second with technology. But there's also something great about being able to connect more. I mean, I'm on everything all the time, so I'm a big fan.
I knew that Julie was getting ready to come to Philadelphia because I read her Facebook post. Getting ready to go to Philadelphia with Erica was on her Facebook. Look, I'm not nostalgic for the past, and I don't want to be an Elizabethan in any way but maybe nailing those love letters to trees. I'm very disturbed about the fact that we don't seem to be able to hold on to feminist advances, that suddenly the Right to Life movement is in charge, and we see states where it's harder and harder for women to get birth control, not just abortion, but birth control. And it seems that the Right to Life movement, in defiance of the overpopulation of the planet, wants to take away not only abortion, but birth control. I am very concerned with how women, feminists, both male and female, can hold on to the things we have achieved. And I think we need a new movement to do that. So I'm not in love with the past or turning back the clock. And I'm very curious about how we can make women's rights stick rather than having this wave-like generational movement where the mother's generation fights for something and the daughter's generation gives it back. I would like us to focus on keeping the things we've won. And it seems instead that feminism goes in a wave-like pattern. And I'm very concerned about that. And I'm trying to figure out how we can make our advances stay. I'd love to hear your ideas about that. And yours too, Ken.
And we had spoken about this too last night. The sort of more frightening aspect of sexuality are the people who, you know, like Scalia in that, just talking about that polygamous lawsuit that the polygamy family is bringing against Utah now because they want to be recognized. And Scalia is arguing that allowing that to happen is sort of a gateway for all sorts of other behaviors, including pornography and masturbation. And it sort of, you know, strikes me, nobody is afraid that a Supreme Court justice, you know, thinks it might be, acceptable to outlaw masturbation. where is the outrage and the sort of scrutiny on that sort of repressed sexuality, and also just outrage an entire swaths of people. Gay people, you know, there's this suppressed rage and homophobia. Nobody talks about that as a scary sexuality. Yet Anthony Weiner's wiener being tweeted is very scary indeed. That's the contradiction there is just to me very disturbing.
I'm very disturbed by all these people who claim they don't like government.
Yeah.
Being for government being in your bedroom and telling you what to do.
Yeah.
There's a great deal of hypocrisy in this peculiar country of ours with these mad people who want to tell you what you can do in the bedroom and think it's perfectly okay. Do you remember Jocelyn Elders made the mistake of saying that she thought masturbation was normal and she was forced to resign? Just for having this commonsensical view as a physician. She wasn't allowed to say that in this peculiar country, the United States of America.
Margaret Sanger was prosecuted, and it just throughout history, you're right, the contradictions with that is just endlessly repeating itself.
Endlessly. Yeah. And, the number of really strong people who wanted to change society, who were ridden out of town on a rail, like Sanger, like Emma Goldman, who was deported. and so on. We have to look at feminism as a core democratic value, and it has to remain. It's as important as the other democratic values in our Constitution. Yes. Two more questions. Who has a burning desire? Burning desire right there.
Many of us read the interview with you and your daughter, Molly, on feministing.com and the New York Magazine article where you basically just gave the speech that you did and your daughter said that global warming was the priority and that women basically had enough rights. I mean, and you know what she said. So for many of us, our feeling is if you can't convince your own daughter, you, of all people, how do we solve this problem in America? Because we think it's really serious, to say nothing about the rest of the world, which I'm also really concerned about. I mean, those interviews had such impact on us.
Well, my daughter is really a feminist. But she's also a satirist, and her mother is excellent material for her. I think she really does believe in women's rights. But anyway, she has never had to fight for women's rights. And that makes her perhaps less interested in the issue. But I believe that as she gets older, she will see it more and more clearly. And I think maybe feministing has skewed the argument to make it funny. Also, if Molly...
You know what was said.
Yeah.
I didn't misunderstand. Molly's really funny, and you can't read that in the articles. I don't think you can hear the tongue in cheek parts of it.
It is.
It
is serious business, and I think, regardless of what Molly Jong Fast thinks, I believe we have to have a movement to hold on to the gains we have made. And this is apart from her satire and her using me as material. I really believe that we need a new feminist movement. And where will it come from? It has to come from a multi-generational effort, and perhaps not from my daughter per se, but from women working together, to women of all generations working together, and men who are feminists working with us to hold on to the gains we have made, and to really see feminism as an aspect of democracy and an aspect of humanism. It is not just something for women. It's something for the entire society. When women control their own fertility, societies prosper and wealth goes up. When women do not, wealth goes down. This has been proven again and again in many parts of the world. So it's really important that we learn how to hold on to those gains. Yes.
You know, I remember reading Fear of Flying, and it was extremely liberating to me. Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you for that. And then I would like to suggest that the more liberated we have actually become, the more repression there is in our society at the same time. And so maybe you can do the same thing for the new generation that you did for my generation, which is try to find a way to talk about this repression that's happening in our country. It's scary. I do think it's something that all generations have to do. But I think maybe that's our new challenge. You certainly met the challenge 40 years ago, or however long ago it was. And I'll bet you're up to meeting that challenge now and helping us out.
Well, I think I have to lead a new march towards women holding on to our freedoms. And we have to recruit men to join with us because feminism also improves the lives of men.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.